This episode of the New York Times Book Review Podcast is brought to you by Voice-Activated Sync, the easy-to-use in-car connectivity system which gives you voice control of mobile phones and MP3 players and features audible turn-by-turn directions and 911 assist. Available exclusively on Ford, Lincoln, and Mercury vehicles. For more details, visit SyncMyRidePodcast.com.
Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with author Jonathan Weiner on the science of immortality.
We'll be young old people. We'll be aging without declining, without growing more frail. That's the dream.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. The Times' dining critic, Sam Sifton, tells us about four endangered wild fish.
On the one hand, we have these perfect, delicious wild animals. Some part of us might say, that's really what we should be eating, is wild fish in moderation. What we learn from Greenberg is there is no moderation.
And Jennifer Schussler has bestseller news. Jonathan Weiner is one of America's best and most honored popular science writers. He's got a new book. It's called Long for This World, The Strange Science of Immortality. It's reviewed for us this week by Abraham Verghese, who says that Weiner's strength as a writer is his ability to flesh out complex theories without losing the reader. And he says, Long for This World is a great trip. I'm delighted that Jonathan Weiner is here to discuss his book with us. Welcome.
Thanks.
What a great topic, because now people really think we can live forever. Not true, but it's become an actual form of science now. Is that right? Longevity and...
It's hot. There are more and more biologists studying aging, and more people seem to feel optimistic. So there's a serious current now in the life sciences where it used to be pie in the sky.
Let's remind our listeners about what life expectancy used to be for human beings, even 100 or 200 years ago.
In the Stone Age, the best estimates say that you were lucky to get a single gray hair. I mean, babies had life expectancies of 20 or 25. That was it. And as recently as 1900, life expectancy in the United States was only 47, 48, 49 in there. It was low. So in the course of the 20th century, we gained 30 years in life expectancy. And now life expectancy in the United States is continuing to increase, and it's up around 80.
Now, some of the change, the dramatic change, has to do with better infant care. Babies don't die as long as they did. And of course, you factor that into the larger numbers. But it also really has to do with our being able, once we get past those early obstacles, actually living longer lives. Why can we do this?
Over the last half century, much of the gain has come from improvements in life expectancy in the second half of life. So we're living longer, we're living healthier lives. Maybe we're doing better at taking care of the elderly. Diet, improvements in diet back 60, 70 years ago, when the current elderly crop was sitting around the kitchen table having breakfast, you know, maybe those improvements, we're seeing that effect now. But no one is entirely sure. If you chart improvement in life expectancy over the last 160 years, it's risen on a straight line. So optimists in gerontology and demography say there's no sign of it slowing down, and they continue to extrapolate it out. At the rate we're going now, if it continues on a straight line, we are now, and this is really paradoxical, but we are now gaining 5 hours of life ahead every day. In other words, every day you live, your life expectancy improves so much because life expectancy is constantly rising that you're getting a gift of another 5 hours down the road.
5 days, you've gained a day. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly.
Now, you also write, this is one of the things you're celebrated for, about some of the scientists and researchers in this field. So tell us about Aubrey de Grey.
He is an extravagant character. He likes to be seen as a character. He's got a beard down to here. He's always got a beer in his hands. He drinks beer from morning till night, and he eats very, very little. But he does expect that he has a very good chance, at least, of living 1,000 years or more. And he sometimes murmurs about 1,000,000 years.
And he's a scientist.
He's a scientist.
Just a fanatic.
That's right. And he's taken seriously by much more conservative gerontologists in the field, which is part of the reason I decided I would follow him. I told him from the beginning that I wasn't following him as a disciple, and I wasn't going to be telling his story uncritically, but that I was willing to listen and try to keep an open mind because there are serious gerontologists who told me some of what he says is good, and he knows his stuff, he knows his field. He's not a charlatan in the, you know, in the traditional sense that so many charlatans have flocked every generation to this field. There is substance there.
And does he do actual research? I mean, serious, verifiable research? How does he make his arguments?
He argues that all we need to do is solve 7 key problems. He's got a 7-point plan for curing aging. And if we can solve all 7, then we could live an extra several decades. And meanwhile, science would continue to advance. And any new problem that came up, we would solve that one down the road.
What are some of the 7?
One is the dread problem of cancer. Another one is the dread problem of Alzheimer's. They tend to be sort of familiar problems. You've heard of them. And for each one, he has a solution that he thinks would work, at least in principle. Some of them are highly original, and scientists are actually pursuing these ideas in laboratories. I mean, the most striking and the most bizarre in some ways is his solution to junk building up in cells that the cells themselves can't digest, that we can't get rid of ourselves. This is called, in some quarters, the garbage catastrophe. That's one of the prevailing theories about aging. Aging is a slow failure of housekeeping in ourselves because there are these bits of crud that we don't know how to get rid of. So Aubrey had one of his great eureka moments some years back, I think in the, must be 10 years ago now. He had this thought, there are living things on this planet that have figured out how to digest that crud, even though we haven't. Where would you look for them? Graveyards. If you dig into the soil in graveyards, you might find microbes that have figured out how to digest everything there is to eat in a graveyard. And this macabre idea actually has caught the curiosity of a number of what are known as bioremediation experts who already engineer microbes to eat, say, oil spills on Louisiana beaches. So if you can force microbes to clean up crud on those beaches, maybe you can also encourage microbes to eat, say, the plaque that builds up in Alzheimer's. And that's one of his solutions to several of the seven deadly things that get us.
Jonathan, you also indicate in the book that there's a philosophical and moral dimension to the whole question of the life cycle. It's something the great poets and artists have written about. Are we sort of psychologically as humans prepared to die?
We are and we aren't. I mean, I think we are the most contradictory mortals on the planet because we know we're mortals. And so we're struggling with these questions from very young. And in that regard, we're all biologists and we're all philosophers because that's the big problem. And we all think about it to some extent. And we think in many different directions. I mean, I devote the last third of the book to exploring these questions. Aubrey and other enthusiasts tend to brush them aside. But it seems to me that they're at least as difficult, the questions of desirability as the questions of feasibility. I mean, can we extend human life dramatically? That's a very difficult biological question. Should we? Do we want to? Is at least as difficult. And probably just as we're sitting here talking, many deep objections have occurred to you. I mean, you have to think about overpopulation, and you have to think about the horrible prospect of boredom. Many people find that the scariest thing about an extra 100 years or 200 years. What would it do to the institution of marriage if when you say, until death do us part, you're talking about 579 years instead of 40 or 50?
And if we live this long, most of that time we'll be old people, right?
Yeah, but we'll be young old people. We'll be aging without declining, without growing more frail. That's the dream. And maybe there's something there, although the conservative gerontologists, which is, you know, almost all the gerontologists besides Aubrey and a handful of others, talk about 7 good years, say, in our lifetimes. Maybe we can add another 7 years or a dozen good years to our life expectancies. And they could be good years, not the lousy dregs at the end of a life. If that could happen, even that would be a dramatic change in society. I mean, we're already going to be grappling with these problems because of global graying, because of the aging of us baby boomers. So I think we're talking about a science with the science of aging that is going to become increasingly hot over the next decades, not only because of real research advances taking place, but because of real desperation. And it's desperation of baby boomers getting older, and it's also desperation of the young sprouts who are going to have to be supporting us baby boomers and carrying us on their backs, and there aren't enough of them.
Thanks a lot, Jonathan.
Thank you.
That's Jonathan Weiner, whose new book, Long for This World, The Strange Science of Immortality, is reviewed in this week's Book Review.
This episode of the New York Times Book Review podcast is brought to you by voice-activated Sync, the in-car connectivity system which gives you voice control of your Bluetooth-enabled mobile phone and most MP3 players. Sync features turn-by-turn directions, 911 assist, real-time traffic and weather, music with the sound of your voice, and text messages read aloud. All hands-free, so you can keep your hands on the wheel and eyes on the road. Available exclusively on Ford, Lincoln, and Mercury vehicles. For more details, visit SyncMyRidePodcast.com.
Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Sam.
So Janet Ivanovich, whom I think of as the Sarah Palin of American Letters, has jumped ship, some would say jumped the shark, and left her publisher. Why?
Well, she was at St. Martin's Press for many years. They've published her since 1998. She was also published at some point by HarperCollins, but this week she announced that she's jumping to Random House. Now, the terms of the deal were not disclosed, but it was reported that she was asking for $50 million for the next 4 books.
These are the books in her best-selling series.
Yes, this is her Stephanie Plum series. Actually, the 4-book deal that she made with Random House will be for 2 books from the Stephanie Plum series and 2 other books from a separate series.
Julie, Random House is a big publishing company. Is she with a specific imprint or house there?
She is. She's going to the Ballantine Bantam Dell imprint, which is not Knopf. It's the kind of imprint that would publish a more mass market fiction.
And she's a hugely successful author. Your predecessor, Motoko Rich, once wrote a story about Janet Ivanovich giving a reading at a casino in Connecticut or something with thousands of people showing up. Is she still that big an attraction? Do they pay a ton of money for these books?
She does sell quite a bit. Her books generally debut as number one on the bestseller list. According to BookScan, which is a company that tracks sales, her most recent book has so far sold about 300,000 copies. And that doesn't include a lot of, you know, big box stores and, you know, Walmart, where she does sell a lot. So she is definitely one of the biggest best-selling authors in American fiction. But I think that her sales power has decreased.
And is that why St. Martin's was willing to let her go rather than match the demand she made?
So St. Martin's says that they had 2 months of negotiations with her over her most recent contract, and they couldn't come to terms. They were not willing to pay her what she wanted to be paid, so they let her go.
So why then would Random House be willing to pay a fee closer to what she demanded? Don't they look at her sales and see that they've decreased a little bit? What's in it for them exactly?
Well, a publisher I talked to yesterday explained it this way. They said every big publishing company wants to have a huge author which lands on the bestseller list. So they want to be able to say Random House has these huge best-selling authors. They think that it attracts other authors to the house. And even though it's the Sarah Palin of American Letters, there's still a certain amount of prestige to getting on the bestseller list. So that may be part of the attraction. But it also seems that Random House is certainly in a position to lose a lot of money.
Hey, Sarah Palin sold 1 million copies of her book. So who knows? Thanks a lot, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
Well, go to any cool restaurant these days and you're likely to be served fish. And there's a new book. It's called Four Fish, The Future of the Last Wild Food. It's by Paul Greenberg. And who better to review it than the Times' own brilliant restaurant critic, Sam Sifton. It's our cover review this week, and Sam's here to talk about it. Welcome.
Nice to be here. Thanks, Sam.
So we have four fish. What are they?
Well, the four fish Greenberg writes about are salmon, tuna, cod, and the fish that we know as branzino, the European sea bass. And these four fish, in his mind and in our reality, represent the fish that create the most problems for us as restaurant goers and indeed as consumers of fish. Tuna, the most wild fish, some would say, now overfished almost to the point of extinction, the bluefin tuna. The cod, a similar fate, a less romantic fish perhaps, but an important fish in the history of the United States, overfished almost to the point of extinction. Salmon, Atlantic salmon, now entirely gone, a wild stock on the East Coast at any rate, and now entirely farmed. And branzino, European sea bass, a fish that is widely farmed in the Mediterranean and almost entirely farmed for us.
Okay, Sam, for someone who is not a credentialed foodie by any means, what's the difference between wild fish and farmed fish?
Wild fish is, as the adjective would imply, actually wild. It is born and raised in the sea, unfettered by government, swims where it wants, and is captured by us humans. Farm fish, aquaculture fish, is largely raised to market on a farm, sometimes in salt waters, which creates all kinds of ecological and environmental and issues going forward, because what if a farmed fish gets into the wild population? And increasingly, as Greenberg writes in this book, far away from the sea in freshwater in ways that are ecologically difficult but do not threaten wild stocks. So we have two competing issues going on in the mind of the consumer and in the future of the world's fish eating. On the one hand, we have these perfect, delicious wild animals. And some part of us might say, that's really what we should be eating, is wild fish in moderation. What we learn from Greenberg is there is no moderation when it comes to wild fish. We are rapacious in our desire to get all of the fish. So we are going to need to look to aquaculture. We're going to need to balance our desire for wild fish against the reality of farm fish and make them work together.
Now, Sam, when did the point come where we began consuming these fish in these dangerous proportions? Is it really a reflection of the changed diet? Fish is better for you? Or?
Well, no, because it depends on the species. In the case of cod, we started to decimate the cod population of the Grand Banks and the Georges Banks off of the U.S. coastline as early as the 18th century. We were taking all of it, drying it in the United States and then shipping it back to Europe for sale. This had been done elsewhere on cod stocks on the other side of the Atlantic, notably in Portugal, where you see salt cod all the time. So cod wiped out or driven close to extinction by our early desire to get all of the cod. Salmon, which is an Andromeda species. It spawns in freshwater and then goes into the sea and then returns to its freshwater source to spawn again. On the East Coast, industrialization killed its chances. The damming of the Connecticut River, the damming of all the coastal rivers from New York north to the Canadian border made it difficult for Atlantic salmon to breed. And so the stocks fell off there. In the case of Branzino, a similar fate in Europe as we had in cod. They were throughout the Mediterranean along the western coast of Europe, picked up. Everyone loves it. And throughout the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries, they were eaten. Now they're farmed throughout the Med. In the case of tuna is different. The bluefin tuna, I mean, not the kind of white tuna we find in cans, but this red tuna that we understand or we recognize from sushi bars mostly, was a trash fish in the United States and indeed in much of the world because it was bloody, fatty. Cats eschewed it. You couldn't sell it in it. There was a sport fishery for it on the East Coast where people would go and catch and harpoon 1,000-pound fish. But then, and I remember this as from childhood, seeing discarded tuna off the dock at the end of fishing tournaments. Greenberg writes about this quite well, about how even in Japan, Otoro, belly tuna, this vibrant red fatty fish was not prized as much as more delicate and fine grained white fishes were. So only really in the 20th century and even in the latter half of the 20th century was there this run on these magnificent giant animals. And that run continues to this day. It's because the tuna do not live in any one particular, they travel thousands and thousands and thousands of miles, and there are a lot of countries going after those fish.
Sam, this book has gotten a lot of attention. There was a big excerpt in the New York Times Magazine. It was a cover story. What is it that Greenberg is bringing to this story that we haven't seen before?
What Greenberg does in Four Fish, and which hasn't been done in a book to date, is to really drill down into this difficulty that we are going to face going forward, which is that we can no longer say, you must eat wild fish and be careful of these farmed species of fish. Aquaculture is bad. Aquaculture causes problems. We must build a sustainable wild fishery. Nor are we going to be able, really, to just eat the aquaculture fish, because there's always going to be a desire and a fishery and a nation that is not governed by the laws that we are governed by going out to get the fish, and that it is in our best interest, both for the fate of the fish and for our own pleasure, to somehow square this circle and figure out how we are going to balance, on the one hand, our desire for wild fish and the necessity of aquaculture fish.
Thanks a lot, Sam.
Thank you, Sam.
That's Sam Sifton, who this week reviews Four Fish, The Future of the Last Wild Food by Paul Greenberg. Jennifer Schuessler is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Sam.
What's new on the list this week?
Everything is Right with the World. You can rest easy. Stieg Larsson is back on top of the fiction list with The Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest.
He seems to be on top of all our lists.
Yes, the first two books in the trilogy are on top of both the trade and the mass market fiction list. So don't cry for Stieg Larsson. And Jennifer Weiner has a new book out. It's called Fly Away Home. It enters at number two, and it's about a senator's extramarital affair and how it affects his wife and daughters, ripped from the headlines.
What about the nonfiction list?
Well, Stuff My Dad Says has been knocked out by Stuff Barack Obama Said. Laura Ingraham enters at number one with her new book, The Obama Diaries. Here she sort of gathers and comments on some secret White House journals she discovered, wink, wink, in the garage of the Watergate complex, nod, nod, and is putting out there for the world to see.
You mean, in other words, she's made all this stuff up?
Yes.
What's it doing on the nonfiction list?
That's a good question, and I would not be surprised if some of our readers don't write in to ask the same thing. In general, satire of this kind, it's obviously fake, it's presented as fake, gets classified as nonfiction. Back in 1991, Millie's book, remember, the memoir by Barbara Bush's...
Oh, the White House dog!
Spaniel, yes. It had a good run on the list, and some readers did write in to question slash complain. So there is some precedent here.
Yeah, speaking of presidential dogs, did Laura Ingraham get a hold of the diaries of Bo, Obama's Portuguese water dog?
She did not, but she does have some fairly salty words for Bo, or maybe not so much for Bo as for the way, in her view, the Obama team sort of cynically put him out there and the way the press lapped it all up.
Any other new titles?
Leanne Tui and Stephen Tui enter at number 10 with their memoir, In a Heartbeat. If those names sort of ring a bell, they are the real-life couple that the bestseller and wildly successful movie The Blind Side was based on. And here they offer their vision of what they call cheerful giving. On the uncheerful side, Bill Madden's biography of George Steinbrenner is back on the list. It's at number 13 this week.
Thanks a lot, Jenny.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing.